This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
All right, what do you think? Can we get through a whole unemployment story without using the word jobs? I think we can, because you know what? Today's unemployment report was actually about something else. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday, the 9th of January today. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. And here is what we are going to do. I'm going to grant myself, and I can do this because it's my show, a one-time exemption on the use of the word jobs to set up our slice of the December unemployment report that came out this morning. The economy added 252,000, here it is, jobs last month. The unemployment rate fell to 5.6%, 5.56%, if you want to be technical about it. Both of those are good and vast improvements over where we started, 2014. Not so good, though. In fact, arguably downright bad, is what people got paid for their work. Average hourly wages were actually down in December. For the year, they were up a measly 1.7%. So instead of a story on today's, well, you know, that word report, here's Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman with today's wage report.
Here's what's supposed to happen salary-wise in a nice, brisk economy like we've got going now.
Hi, Amanda. So what did you want to come in and talk about?
I found this how-to video from Self Magazine on YouTube.
I'd like to talk to you about the possibility of a promotion to associate here and a raise as well.
Okay, great. Let's talk about it.
Except in the real world, Amanda's boss isn't all, let's talk about it. She's more likely to say, you already got a 2% raise. That's it for now. 2%, about how much prices have been going up every year, says Elise Gould at the Progressive Economic Policy Institute.
Once you look at inflation, inflation-adjusted wage growth has been around zero for the last 5 years.
It shouldn't happen this way. If the economy's creating a lot of openings and unemployment's falling, employers should be worried about finding enough people with the right skills to hire, so they should offer more money. If you're good and you threaten to walk, they should offer you a raise to stay around, explains Bernie Baumol at the Economic Outlook Group.
If these factors are not enough to keep the economy growing with rising wages, then we really do have to go back to the drawing board and revisit everything we know about how economies work.
Now, Baumol's convinced once labor shortages really start to bite and companies just can't get the work done anymore, they will raise wages to attract and keep good employees who can do the job. But conservative economist Peter Morici at the University of Maryland isn't at all sure that'll happen.
So many people have dropped out of the labor market. If wages started rising again, they would return. So there's really this large contingent supply of labor.
There are as many as 6 million potential workers who aren't even looking anymore, but need to find work and make an income. They're like a second string, a bench, keeping the players who are on the field looking over their shoulders and loath to ask for a raise. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
We've got wages in Europe and so much more to wrap up the week. For that, we've got Catherine Rampell from The Washington Post in a rare solo appearance. Hey, Catherine.
Hey, Kai.
So give me your gut check on the jobs report. Numbers, obviously good. Wages, really troubling, yeah?
Yeah, that's basically the headline. You know, the jobs numbers have been very good, not just in December, but, you know, in sort of the look back for the year that just passed. They've been excellent. I think we've seen our unemployment rate drop at the fastest rate since, I don't know, sometime in the 80s, yeah. I think is what I saw earlier today. So generally, in terms of job growth, you know, kind of across the board, it's been quite good.
Is this the new normal, though, where we're growing jobs and wages are stuck and people just have to get used to it? Because that's really unappealing, right?
I think that's unlikely, although it really depends on what you think is behind the wage stagnation. We generally think that wages or wage hikes, I should say, lag job growth. You know, that kind of you need to see a tightening labor market before employers start feeling pressure to increase wages. So it's possible that they're just around the corner. You know, if you look at surveys of consumers, they seem to think that they're likely to get a raise sometime pretty soon. Same thing with small businesses. But if you think that wage stagnation is driven by other causes, like the decline in labor unions or sort of more structural things that predate the recession, then that might lead you to a different conclusion.
Yeah, the idea that they're just around the corner, I mean, that and $4.50 get you a cup of coffee at Starbucks, right? I mean,
That's true. I mean, maybe it's wishful thinking, but at some point, as I said, if the labor market tightens up enough, then employers may be left with no other option.
All right. Well, we'll see what happens on that one. Let me turn you now to Europe. Not the events of the day, of course, but the larger economic story that unfolded earlier this week, reports of deflation and a possible recession over there. How worried are you that that actually is going to stick and Europe's going to honestly crater again?
Do you think that they're not cratering now, I guess, is the question. They have a lot of problems right now. They've continued to have a lot of problems. Relative to the United States, they're doing quite poorly. Some countries are, their GDP is still shrinking.
Yeah.
Italy comes to mind. You know, they've done pretty badly. But a bunch of other countries that are finally growing again are still very much in the hole. So the numbers indicating that Europe is on the threat of deflation, as they were a couple of years ago, are quite troubling, just because they're facing so many other obstacles. Mm-hmm. You know, there's the Greek elections coming up, and it looks likely that will lead to another showdown over the restructuring or a restructuring, I guess, of Greek debt.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's quite a bit of economic turmoil that's been brewing for a while. And you add deflation to that mix where you worry that consumers are going to put off purchases because they're just waiting for prices to keep dropping lower. And you really face some serious issues.
We seem so strong now, no, relatively speaking, right? I mean, our jobs are growing and all this stuff. Do you see a risk to us, or are we going to be strong enough to pull everybody else through?
I think at home, people don't feel quite as optimistic as maybe the comparison to Europe would lead us to believe
we should be. Right, that's an important point, right?
Yes, I think that's absolutely true. You know, if you look at, for example, some economic confidence numbers from Gallup, they have this monthly – or actually, I think it's actually a poll that's done daily, but they sort of released snapshots once a month that basically shows that for the first time since at least 2008, consumers are finally slightly more positive on the economy than they are negative. Like they're just barely more likely to say that things are improving than things are deteriorating.
Yeah.
So at home, I think people are not quite as buoyant as maybe they should be, I guess, if they compared themselves to peers.
Yeah.
In terms of your question about what the risks are, you know, Europe is still very much a risk. They're a trading partner of ours, and there are maybe some contagion effects that we could worry about. You also have some problems in emerging markets around the country.
Right.
China is slowing down. Places like Venezuela and Russia worried about what's going to happen in their future.
Now you're just depressing me, Catherine.
I know. I'm sorry. Well, you asked me about risks.
I did. There you go. All right.
I'm not saying they're big risks.
Catherine Rampell from The Washington Post. Thank you, Catherine.
Thank you.
Talk to you soon. On Wall Street today, a loser from open to close. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. President Obama's pre-State of the Union roadshow continued today in Knoxville, Tennessee. He was out talking about a couple of his favorite subjects, getting more kids into college and making college more affordable, or in this case, free. The president said he wants the federal government to pay for 2 years of community college for most Americans. It's going to be expensive, and Congress would have to approve it, which means it is also going to be dicey. But still, the idea is causing something of a stir in education circles. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has the story.
Under the plan, the federal government would cover three-quarters of the average cost of 2 years of community college. States would have to pony up the rest. Students would have to keep their grades up. President Obama unveiled the program at a Knoxville community college surrounded by students who loved the idea of free tuition.
I want to make it free.
The plan is also being applauded in some academic circles. Here's Thomas Bailey, director of the Community College Research Center at Teachers College, Columbia University.
Students who go to community colleges and get associate's degrees, as well as students who get bachelor's degrees, end up earning significantly more than students who, say, stop at high school.
Lauren Asher agrees. She's president of the Institute for College Access and Success, but she wishes President Obama had targeted the money just to the neediest students instead of making everybody eligible.
You're spreading available resources across many that don't need them and leaving those with the greatest need still facing substantial affordability barriers.
But that's probably beside the point, because congressional Republicans who control Congress aren't likely to approve the president's plan. Still, there's optimism. Matt Reed is vice president for academic affairs at Holyoke Community College. He says just the publicity from the president could make low-income students more aware of financial aid that's already available.
The headline, free community college, is valuable in itself if it sort of plants the seed that you can do this.
President Obama will spell out the cost of his plan later this month. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
I don't want to get too far ahead of things, but the first week of the 114th Congress is barely in the books, and hey, look at that, they already passed a bill. Of course, it was a bill that was supposed to be passed last year, but last year wasn't so collegial in Washington, now was it? When it is signed by the president, which it will be, the bill in question, it's called the Terrorism Risk Insurance Act, means the U.S. government will continue to act as a backstop for insurers who face massive losses after a terrorist attack. Bearing in mind the events of the day in Paris, Marketplace's David Gura explains why the U.S. government is in the insurance business at all.
Terrorism risk insurance is not a new thing, but before 9/11, it wasn't something most businesses thought about. It was just part of most commercial property coverage.
And then once 9/11 happened, insurers started to exclude terrorism from their policies.
Lloyd Dixon studies risk management at the Rand Corporation, and he says insurers paid $32 billion to victims of the terrorist attacks on 9/11. Erwan Michel Karjan also studies risk management. He teaches at the Wharton School.
Basically, the insurance companies told the government, we don't want to touch that risk anymore.
So in 2002, the federal government stepped in, telling insurers they have to offer terrorism insurance, and the government will act as a backstop. Now, 60% of businesses have this kind of coverage, says Tom Santos, a lobbyist for the American Insurance Association, coverage for buildings, but also for big events like, say, the Super Bowl.
This is truly a partnership between the government and the private sector.
Critics say the program is a gift to insurance companies. Santos says the private sector is not getting off easy. It would have to pay what he says is a substantial amount.
The current estimate today, that's somewhere in the neighborhood of $30 to $35 billion.
Then taxpayers would cover the rest. The trouble with terrorism risk insurance, Santos says, is that you can't possibly predict when or where an attack will take place.
We need those two key pieces of data in order to accurately underwrite the risk.
Without a government backstop, he says, terrorism risk insurance would get a lot more expensive, and some insurers might stop offering it altogether. I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
The extravaganza that is the Consumer Electronics Show closes its doors today. After a week of fun in Las Vegas, thousands of companies and wannabe entrepreneurs are going to pack up their gadgets and go home, all the while crossing their fingers that they made some kind of an impression on somebody, that their product will fly, if you will. Marketplace's Nova Sappho has been at the show all week and has this report from the Drone Zone.
At the Las Vegas Convention Center, you can hear them before you see them. Drones, big ones, small ones. For the first time, drone makers had their own section at the show. Not a surprise given that the flying, buzzing machines are projected to bring in more than $100 million this year.
I mean, we sold 15,000 units for our Kickstarter, so it's been pretty big.
That's Reese Crowther, product designer for a palm-sized drone called Xano. It can follow you around and take photos and video. selfie make way for the droney.
We developed it with the intention of being used in law enforcement and military applications, and we still use that. Xano is a consumer version of that technology.
A version that will cost $300 when it lands in the U.S. this summer. Almost all the drone makers here are aiming at consumers with small models crammed with sophisticated sensors and guidance systems. On the other end of the spectrum is the Chinese drone manufacturer Harwar. Frank Yang is with the company.
For us, it's more focused on high-end commercial use.
Those high-end commercial use drones cost thousands of dollars, and they're imposing, the size of a microwave and can fly to 15,000 feet. The FAA is still drawing up rules for big drones like Harwar's. Jim Williams heads the agency's office in charge of unmanned aircraft, and outside the exhibit hall, in a jam-packed conference room, he said the agency is trying to figure out just how regulated drones need to be.
There already is a graduated level of certification required based on the risk. We plan to fit unmanned aircraft into that same risk-based approach that we have for manned aircraft.
That could mean requiring a drone operator to have a pilot's license or for the drones to have sophisticated communications equipment. The little guys like Xano don't have to worry about those things. The FAA considers them hobby aircraft. But there are some rules. They have to fly under 400 feet, avoid areas around airports.
You don't want to be flying in urban areas. You don't want to be flying, over top a lot of people.
Gordon Cockburn is with Hobico, one of the biggest makers of radio-controlled toys and now drones.
So what we suggest is that you fly in the open space, in near nature, over the ocean.
Or you could do it the way they flew drones at CES, in small areas surrounded by nets. In Las Vegas, I'm Novosoffo for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Well, I've never had a car payment since. And they do everything except put the gas in and change the oil.
Amazingly, not a story about cars at all. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 170 points today, 0.9%, closed at 17,737. The NASDAQ off 32 points, 2/3%, 4704 at the bell. The S&P 500 gave back 17 points, 0.8%, ended things at 2,044. For the week gone by, the Dow and the NASDAQ both shed 0.5%, the S&P 500 down 0.6%. Gold traded higher today, and so did shares of gold producers. Harmony Gold Mining was up 9.75%. In corporate news, Macy's said it would close 14 stores later this year and focus instead on in-store pickups for folks who place orders online. What could possibly go wrong? Shares in the department store chain sank 2.75%. You're listening to Marketplace.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. The North American International Auto Show opens in Detroit with press preview days. The Transportation Research Board continues its annual meeting in Washington. And it's the anniversary of Batman's TV premiere. The Caped Crusader began fighting crime in front of home audiences on January 12, 1966. The first episode ended with a cliffhanger. After having been kidnapped, Robin was apparently in great danger. Pow! I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. 15 years ago, Google had been an actual incorporated company for just over 2 years. Mark Zuckerberg, of Facebook fame to come, was 15 years old. And AOL Time Warner, on the 10th of January, 2000, 15 years ago tomorrow, announced the biggest and still the most cursed corporate merger in the history of corporate anything. At one point, AOL Time Warner, as it became known, lost nearly $100 billion in a single year. Sally Herships has this post-mortem.
I'm not even going to bother to be polite about this merger.
Pretty much everything went horribly wrong with that deal.
Kevin Warbeck teaches legal studies and business ethics at Wharton. He says, at the time, right before the dot-com bubble burst, everyone was telling Time Warner it needed an in to this new internet media world. And the easiest way to do that would be by merging with a company that already got it. Here's some news clips from 2000.
The merger of the number one internet company with the number one media company will bring together the best of both worlds.
I did it with as much or more excitement and enthusiasm as I did on that night when I first made love some 42 years ago.
We are the missing piece of each other's puzzle.
Warbeck says the idea was that Time Warner's content plus AOL's distribution network would somehow be more powerful together.
it's ironic in some ways because Time Warner was really the desperate party that wanted to do this deal because they wanted to get access to this sexy go-go internet.com magic. But in hindsight, AOL was the company that was about to fall off a cliff.
And one man figured that out. Alec Klein is author of Stealing Time, Steve Case, Jerry Levin, and the Collapse of AOL Time Warner. At the time, he was a reporter investigating the company.
But the problem is that AOL was not doing as well as it seemed.
Klein found out AOL was improperly inflating its ad revenue. Dial-up modems were on their way out, broadband on its way in. And things did not go well from there.
They were, after our investigation, were investigated by the Justice Department, the Securities and Exchange Commission. People were fired.
And the people were yet another part of the merger problem.
Oh, absolutely. I think culture is usually to blame when these things go horribly wrong.
Rita McGrath teaches strategy and innovation at Columbia Business School. She says, think about why one company buys another.
In this day and age, most of the time you're not buying the assets or the physical things. You're really buying the talent and the goodwill and the engagement of the people.
McGrath says the anxiety and excitement about the digital economy then is similar to what it is today. The future is coming, but still no one knows just what it will be. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Probably by now, or at least one hopes that by now, all the leftovers from your holiday meals have been taken care of. But before you ate it all up, where'd you put it? Well, you put it in the fridge, of course, but inside what? Tupperware, probably, or some knockoff thereof. Gigi Duban has the Tupperware origin story.
Take one look at the kitchen, and there's no question what goes on in this house.
My name is Wanda Clay. And I've been in Tupperware like 43 years.
Clay calls herself the Tupperware lady. I'm not even in her house 4 minutes before she starts pulling out stuff to show me.
And it is microwavable pressure cooker. You can cook like roast, whatever you want to cook, and it comes with a cookbook.
Then she tells me about all the perks she's gotten selling Tupperware over the years. Trips to Hawaii and Paris, a grandfather clock, a piano. In 1971, she got her first car through Tupperware sales, a light blue Ford Torino.
Well, I've never had a car payment since, and they do everything except put the gas in and change the oil.
Clay is a perfect example of the kind of woman Tupperware recruited, and still does, to sell. A wife and mom who wanted to earn money without sacrificing the home life. But the Tupperware lady wouldn't exist if it weren't for a woman named Brownie Wise. She was a saleswoman for Tupperware back in the 50s. But before we tell you about her, let's stop for a moment to tell you about the man who invented Tupperware, Earl Tupper.
Tupper created a product that he based after a paint can and a paint can lid that had that airtight seal.
Bob Keeling is the author of the book Tupperware Unsealed. He says Tupper tried selling these airtight containers at stores, but that didn't go so well. Keeling says that's because people didn't know what to do with them. And that's where Brownie Wise comes in. It was her idea to pull the product off store shelves and sell exclusively in homes.
Wise figured out that it was the ideal home demonstration product so you could show people.
The one way to buy Tupperware is a fun way. At a Tupperware home party.
Here's a little bit from a Tupperware promotional video.
Where you can see it demonstrated and order the Tupperware you need in fresh sun, sea, and sky colors.
And that's when sales took off. Keeling says Tupperware's success came down to two things. What was then a revolutionary product that saved money, containers for leftovers, and these parties Brownie Wise came up with that let women get together and talk and eat and shop.
So it was much larger than just a sales technique. It became a social phenomenon. That was a key to her success.
Soon, Wise was promoted to head up Tupperware's home parties division. She moved into a lakeside mansion in Florida. By then, she'd built up a huge following. But Keeling says Tupper feared Wise was letting her name get bigger than the brand itself.
And then Earl Tupper fired her, kicked her out of the house, which she did not own.
Months later, Tupper sold the company for $16 million. Brownie Wise?
She walked away with $35,000 in severance.
After that, the way Keeling tells it, Wise pretty much faded into obscurity. Still, she paved the way for all the home party systems that came later, like Mary Kay and Pampered Chef. Two nights after we meet, Wanda Clay is having a Tupperware party of her own at one woman's house.
And I'm going to fit it in there, and you're not going to believe how fast it cuts.
Clay is making salsa, throwing together a taco salad, making a refried bean casserole. She shows off a food chopper that's also a salad spinner, and it makes ice cream and smoothies. It's like watching a live infomercial.
And it's got the cover on it. You cannot buy these. And so when you date your party, you can take one of these with you.
Tonight was a decent night for Wanda Clay. She sold more than $500 worth. She'll take home at least 35%. And she just ordered her newest car, a 2015 Buick Enclave, courtesy of Tupperware. In Birmingham, I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, in which it turns out that capitalism might work in Sony's favor. We were talking yesterday about how the FBI still thinks the North Koreans were behind the hack of the studio over its film, The Interview, about North Korea. From Bloomberg today, this item, best guesses are that between online sales and rentals and the international market, Sony is going to make about $60 million from that film, which, because the marketing budget was necessarily curtailed after it was pulled from theaters, means they will, in the end, just about break even. So there you go. All right, it's Friday. We're out of here. The Dow off 170 points to end the week, 0.9%. The NASDAQ off 32 points, 0.2%. The S&P 500 gave back 17 points, 0.8%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace was developed by J.J. Yor. The program is produced by Sitar Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer around here. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have a good weekend, all right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.